This week, in July of 1945, the United States ran the first test of the atomic bomb. The test, planned secretly, was given the codename Trinity. It took place in New Mexico. Thunderstorms that morning almost derailed the whole thing, but at 5:30 a.m., a mushroom cloud erupted over the desert. A general watching from a bunker described the searing light of the explosion as a thing of beauty. He marveled at the colorful display of gold, purple, and blue. Another observer saw things differently. He said, "It is safe to say that nothing as terrible has been made by man before." The president was Harry S. Truman, and just a few short weeks later, he made this announcement to the nation.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction.
And so began the nuclear age. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Today, we're going to explore the complicated legacy of Truman and the atomic bomb, starting with Richard Rhodes. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb, and he grew up in Kansas City. Richard Rhodes, it is an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
You were a young boy when all of this was happening, and of course, the test I just described was a secret. The government told people that the explosion they'd witnessed was from an ammunition dump. But what do you remember from those weeks in the summer of 1945?
I remember how frustrated and angry Americans were that the Japanese had not surrendered. We had destroyed their air force. We had destroyed their navy. Their home islands were blockaded so that food couldn't go in and out. There was every reason why they should have considered themselves defeated, and they didn't. And it immensely frustrated and angered everyone. We wanted the war over. It had been going on since 1942. Many, many thousands and hundreds and millions of lives had been lost. That was a visible part of that period of time.
So like frustration that the war wouldn't end?
Yeah, because Germany had been defeated. The war in Europe had been long over since the early in May. And yet this thing dragged on in the Pacific War to everyone's immense frustration. And, you know, at a government level, there was a similar frustration because there was a very clear sense that the only way we were going to defeat the Japanese definitively was to invade their home islands. And everyone understood that as the war had moved up a string of Pacific islands, one by one, with names that people my age all remember, like Guadalcanal and so on. But by the time it got to the islands close to Japan, the Japanese were basically committing suicide. The civilians actually were jumping off cliffs. The soldiers and Marines in the Japanese military were fighting to the death, almost to the last man. And we just thought, if we invade their homelands, there's going to be a terrible slaughter on both sides.
How old were you in 1945?
I was 8 years old.
So how much of that did you understand?
Well, you know, what I understood once the atomic bombings were announced, as an eight-year-old boy who had grown up, whose whole childhood had been the war, one of my earliest memories, I would have been 4 years old, was going with my older brother Stanley from house to house in our neighborhood in Kansas City, knocking on doors and saying, "The Japs bombed Pearl Harbor." And we were absolutely amazed at what a stir that simple sentence caused to the families who opened the door. They would turn on lights and run to the living room and turn on the radio. We didn't really understand what that meant. But the war period was one where everything changed around us. Gasoline was rationed. rubber tires were impossible to get for automobiles. So the streets suddenly emptied out of cars and we could play in the streets. The home delivery of bread and milk and ice for our ice boxes, the predecessor to the refrigerator, was all delivered by truck. But because the trucks couldn't get gasoline, Manor Bread, for example, resuscitated their old horse-drawn bread wagons. And suddenly we dropped back to another era. But at the same time, on every block, certainly on our block, there would be black crepe flags, shields in the windows of a few houses with a gold star woven onto them, which meant that someone in that house, a father or brother or a son, had died, had been killed in the war.
So death was everywhere, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And underlying this seemingly bucolic sort of world that we as children were playing in. So there was this double sense. And for a sensitive little boy, you felt that. You had a sense that something was going on and that it was profound. So when the bombs suddenly seemed to bring an end to the war, I became interested at that point in science. I wanted to know what amazing force this was and began reading about science and getting interested in it.
Well, you know, that does bring up the question of how much the general public, including children, really knew about what an atomic bomb even was. The whole concept was so new, and especially against the backdrop you're describing of people kind of having gone back to another era in so many ways.
Right. The equivalent of network television in 1945 was big picture magazines like Life magazine. And they began to run a whole series for years afterwards of articles about nuclear physics. I mean, whatever I learned up through the end of grade school about physics was from Life magazine, with wonderful illustrations indicating what atomic structures were and what a nucleus was and so on. So it was possible to learn, if you wanted to, about this extraordinary new weapon. People perhaps who weren't interested in the science still had a sense that this was somehow what one historian calls the winning weapon. So we felt as if somehow we had finally dominated this dark world of fascism in Japan and in Germany and had a weapon that would protect us forever, which of course was not really the case, although to some degree it was.
Well, what was it years later that inspired you to begin researching the making of the atomic bomb, like formally researching?
Well, again, I think that experience as a child was the emotional context for being interested in that story. My first five books, the first one was about the Middle West, a nonfiction book, but my next four books were novels. And I was working on a novel based on a story that I thought was a real story, a true story, that I thought was actually set at Los Alamos, the laboratory where the first bombs were actually designed and built. So I got very interested in looking up the history of all of that. The novel was not a success. It's the only book I've ever written that wasn't publishable. But when I sat down to figure out why, I realized that this novel, which was a story of one human being, basically, just was overwhelmed by the sheer richness and mass of detail of that of the Manhattan Project and of the development of the first atomic bombs. And then there was a fortuitous event that year, which was around 1975, that also helped out, which was the government declassified really almost literally a warehouse full of documents about the Manhattan Project. And it became possible for the first time to tell the story as historians like to, from documentary sources, rather than simply from interviewing people who had been involved, who were, of course, constrained by secrecy from saying very much anyway. So those things all came together, and I realized that the way to tell the story was to tell it as a work of nonfiction. And then in Kansas City, spent the next 5 years working on this very rich and complicated story.
You know, the bomb itself comes with so many ethical dilemmas, but so does the test, which was conducted in a part of New Mexico that was sparsely populated, but not empty. I mean, there were ranches nearby, and the government, if I understand correctly, buried photographic papers near towns to be able to document radioactivity for years to come.
Yes, really, it was not clear until the bomb exploded what its yield really would be. Yield meaning how explosive it was. So, for example, a lot of the scientists who were down there to observe the test, they had a betting pool going. And the pool varied from a dud, basically no yield, to hundreds of thousands of tons. So the Army Corps of Engineers, which was running the Manhattan Project, had to prepare for the possibility that the bomb might destroy the state of New Mexico. And they had various layers of possible press releases. The one that actually went out said an ammunition dump had blown up. But it would have been possible that they might have had to evacuate the whole state if the radioactivity was much higher than it actually was. They did, of course, evacuate the region around the test site. And it was a pretty barren part of New Mexico, which is a fairly barren state anyway. But there was residual radioactivity, I think not enough for anybody really to have worried about. There were some cattle, for example, that were close to the downwind of the test site who were actually had some hair loss afterwards, which is a sign of a fairly substantial dose of radiation. So it was there. They took every precaution they could.
Can you help us, just as someone who's looked into the science and thought about the physical aspect of this explosion, can you help us understand the sheer power of an atomic bomb?
Well, you know, the TNT equivalent is about as close as anyone has come. But I think you have to think about the nuclear reaction that takes place in an atomic bomb when it chain reacts, produces a fireball that is about 300 million degrees in temperature. So it's like a little star. For a real little star, you need a hydrogen bomb. That's the kind of reaction that goes on in the sun, the thermonuclear fusion reaction. But fission reaction, where uranium splits and releases energy in the form of heat, is plenty hot and plenty powerful. So you have a fireball that's basically like a little sun. It expands very rapidly with enormous blast force as this wave of shock pushes outward. It cools as it expands, and you don't even see it until it cools to 10,000 degrees, because that's the temperature of the bluest light that we ever see. Before that, it's radiating as X-rays and gamma rays and neutrons and all sorts of things. This little ball of star-like fire simply blows away and burns out. I don't know if your listeners remember or have seen some of the photographs of people who were Japanese civilians who were affected by the bombings. But there's a picture that's quite famous of a woman who has the pattern of her kimono burned into her back. That's like this flash of light is the world's worst sunburn, although it can be even worse than that. So I think it's very hard to imagine explosions on this scale. They're not as big as volcanic eruptions. The Mount St. Helens explosion was something like 10 million tons of TNT, 10 megatons. So something like one of our biggest hydrogen bombs. But even a bomb like the Hiroshima bomb, which had a yield of about 13,500 tons of TNT equivalent, basically destroyed the entire downtown area of a large city and started a mass fire, which is the real effect of these weapons. They're really fire weapons. Started a mass fire that burned out the entire delta of the river that Hiroshima is built on. Or to take another example that I use sometimes, if we exploded one of our 300 kiloton bombs over the Pentagon at an altitude of, 2,000 feet, it would just burn out everything all the way out to the outer highway around Washington, D.C.
You know,
they're immensely powerful.
We're going to be delving into the really complicated ethics of all of that, but I think that pretty well lays the groundwork for some of that. Richard Rhodes, stay with me, okay?
Sure.
I'm going to bring in someone from the Truman Library and Independence. Mark Adams, good morning.
Good morning.
So before we get into sort of the like moral equations this all inspires, talk to me about Truman's role in all of this. In the speech we heard a clip of earlier in the show, he's reading from this prepared statement, and he sounds like he might be almost as new to the concept of the atomic bomb as his listeners.
Well, absolutely. First, some context, he'd only become president in April of that year, and we're talking August for his decision for Hiroshima and July for the testing. So he'd only been vice president 82 days. Inauguration was in January. He'd actually only met FDR twice in that time period. And so his context and his background, he knew nothing of the Manhattan Project while he was vice president. One of the first letters he gets from the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, was to tell him, I need to talk to you about a secret project. And so he gets that information in April of 1945. And so as vice president, and then in his first days of president, he knows nothing of that.
How does he get caught up?
Well, and I've been reading about that. You know, I've been working at the Truman Library 20 years, and one of the things you realize very quickly is that Truman is an avid reader, even as a child. And he continued that in his presidency. And I hear Mr. Rhodes laughing because it's just a standard line you see in every biography. They use that phrase, avid reader, and he took that into the presidency. And there's, you know, we have oral histories at the Truman Library from his advisors, and they talk about he reads. He's up late reading. He's up early reading. He's reading all the time.
So he had just a short time to go from the knowledge that such a thing as the Manhattan Project is even taking place, that an atomic bomb is being developed, what that might be, to making a decision to test one in New Mexico and drop two in Japan.
Right.
And I'm curious, you know, he hits the books as his way of navigating this. What were the factors that ultimately led to his decision to go ahead with this thing?
I think he had one goal, and that was to end the war as soon as possible. And by ending the war as soon as possible, the biggest consequence of that would be to save American lives. And I don't think he ever wavered from that, either as president or even in retirement. He wanted to end the war as quickly as he could to save as many American lives as he could. And he had that goal, and he just stuck with that one aim.
He calls this, later in the speech we just heard, he calls this the greatest accomplishment of organized science. Was he kind of in awe just of what human beings could do, their ability to unleash the power of science in a dramatic way?
I think, you know, in terms of the scientific breakthrough, without looking at the, you know, the political and the morality and all of those other side issues we're going to discuss, in terms of scientific breakthrough, it was momentous. There's no doubt about that. It was a huge scientific breakthrough on the technological side. And so I think he recognized that. He, you know, he talked with many advisors and with some of the scientists, and he realized what a huge breakthrough they had made. And of course, it was a race. I mean, they realized other countries were trying to do this too. And it was kind of like their version of landing on the moon. They did it first.
Richard Rhodes, what would you say was the prevailing attitude about science at the time? Did that affect how people heard this news?
There was a great deal more awe directed towards science, and I think also fear. I mean, the mad scientist was the trope then as it is today, although it's shifted now maybe to digital. But so people didn't. And the average educational level in the United States was, I think it was eighth grade at that point. It wasn't much higher than that. So you have to think of a country where people don't necessarily have much background in science, even in their public school years. So to them, I think, I mean, there's a famous Arthur Clarke statement that anything sufficiently scientifically advanced is impossible to distinguish from magic. And I think to some degree, this seemed almost magical, particularly in the context of ending the war.
That's Richard Rhodes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb. If you have a question about the moral legacy of Truman's decision to drop the atomic bomb, call 816-235-2888. A moral philosopher will be joining us after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Mark Adams of the Truman Library and Richard Rhodes, the Kansas City native who wrote The Making of the Atomic Bomb, among other books. We're remembering this week in July of 1945 when the first test of the atomic bomb took place in Mexico. The president was Missouri's son, Harry S. Truman. I'd like to bring in a moral philosopher to hear how his field might treat Truman's decision to bomb Japanese cities later that summer. Adrian Switzer, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So in moral philosophy, there's this whole thing where, you know, if you take just an introductory class, you'll hear about, imagine you're the conductor of a train and the train is headed toward all these people. Unless you change tracks and hit only one person instead, you know, what's the right decision here? Well, you know, in one case, you're making an active decision, but the passive decision, more deaths occur, that kind of stuff. I thought your field might have some insight for us.
Right. Yeah. So that way of thinking about ethics, and it has a fair amount of kind of intuitive sense that if you can just kind of weigh the pros and cons of a decision, that could be at least a justifiable grounds for making, you know, one choice. I don't think either of those choices, you know, seem particularly great, but if we could weigh out, you know, the death or life of a certain number of people versus the death or life of another group of people, and think about, I think Truman, from what I understand, was thinking along these lines that, well, if we continue on with the war, we'll have many more deaths than if we make this, you know, quite a striking decision to use this technology. And, you know, he kind of used this calculation, this utilitarian, for the technical term for this, a utilitarian calculation of, you know, it would be better in a kind of thinking about life in general and thinking about the expenditures of life and the exposure of American soldiers to the, you know, the hardships of war and the long protracted invasion of the island, that it would just be, you know, again, between kind of two not great options, this seems to be the better of the options. But I would say that I understand how you see this as an example, but it's almost like there wasn't a precedent for this before. Like this isn't just like one among those kinds of decisions. You know,
what was unprecedented?
Well, I mean, just this. The use of technology, scientific technology, that at the time, it seems like we didn't, I mean, I don't know the history of it that well, but we didn't have our hands or our heads really around how extensive this was, and comparing it to traditional weaponry when we know that there are a lot of non-traditional features of this weaponry, that this strikes me as not quite like the other kinds of examples of calculating between, you know, again, this kind of difficult decision to risk these many lives and save these many lives, that the nuclear bomb becomes kind of like a case unto itself, an instance unto itself, just because of how there wasn't really a way to anticipate what this technology is going to look like, how extensive the damage was going to be, and these kind of things. So if that makes...
It does. Yeah. You know, one of the things we also haven't factored in is that, is there a question of, as president of one particular nation, prioritizing some lives over others?
Right. Yeah. So it's not merely a purely quantitative calculation that Truman's going through. He's not saying, you know, 250,000 lives versus 150,000 lives. He's saying 150,000 American lives. And as, you know, the president of this country, there has to be obviously a bias towards towards protecting the lives of his citizenry and his constituency. So I do think there's another layer of moral decision that goes on there that, and this is a challenge to a kind of pure utilitarian calculation, that often you put your finger on the scale, so to speak, because you value certain ideas or certain groups more than other groups. And, you know, this is, again, justifiable for the president of the United States to weigh American lives more heavily than Japanese lives. I would say I just wanted to add that, so I grew up kind of in the next or next, next generation, and listening to Richard talk about the nuclear testing and its and how it was perceived and these kind of things, I came from the generation that came after that, you know, nuclear weapons were seen as just, you know, this great threat, and, you know, that it was very dangerous.
Duck and cover.
And, yeah, duck and cover. I mean, I'm a little young to have gone through, you know, having a fallout shelter built into the backyard. But I mean, I knew people, I'm from Philadelphia originally, and I knew people who, you know, still had provisions in the basement about, you know, when the bomb came. And so my generational understanding of this is a bit different than Richard. So I was really appreciated hearing the different view on it. Yeah.
Richard, mm-hmm. jump in.
I was going to say, let me add a little bit of historical context to this question. First of all, in fact, the decision, although I don't know whether Truman considered this or not, the decision saved not only many American lives, but also, of course, many Japanese lives, perhaps more Japanese lives than American. But there was we made the moral judgment about bombing cities in Europe in 1943, when we began basically firebombing German cities, to loss of life comparable to the loss of life, at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had already burned out, Curtis LeMay and his B-29 fleets had already burned out every Japanese city of more than 50,000 population. The only reason Hiroshima and Nagasaki were still there to be atomic bombed is that they had been deliberately set aside as potential atomic bomb targets. And the General Groves, who ran the Manhattan Project, wanted to be able to assess the results of the bombing. So he needed a more or less pristine city. So in a sense, Hiroshima, for example, had 3 months longer without being destroyed than it would have had otherwise. That's just an irony. That's not a moral judgment. But my point is, these issues, in a way, had already been settled. And the fact that an atomic bomb would have other effects than basically the same effects as firebombing really was not yet much apparent. The scientists at Los Alamos set up the way this bomb would be used to explode at about 1,800 yards above ground, because that way they figured it wouldn't produce any fallout. And anyone who was irradiated by the prompt neutrons coming off of the fireball would probably be killed by blast anyway. So there was some balancing of these moral issues, but it was in a much more, if you will, technological context than the purer way of thinking about it.
Let's hear from Mark Adams from the Truman Library.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about the morality of it, when Truman, you know, we have thousands and millions of Truman documents at the library, and when he's asked about that while president and then after his presidency, he often used one line. And he would just say, remember Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
because that's where morality to him, the sneak attack, as he would use it, I'm using his words rather than mine, he would refer back to that sneak attack and remind people of the devastation at Pearl Harbor and the lives that were lost there. The other point, when Richard mentioned the casualties under Japanese occupation in June of 1945, about approximately 100,000 non-combatants that were under Japanese control were being killed every month.
How is the moral question affected by the announcement after the fact saying, you know, essentially saying this is not just an act in and of itself, but this is a threat going forward? I mean, that has characterized international relations ever since.
The discussion that went on at Potsdam in a conference between Truman and Stalin and who was the Brit?
Churchill.
Was it Churchill or
Churchill initially, and then Attlee came in halfway through after
yes,
the election.
Yes, exactly right. The discussion that went on there included the pressure that Truman was getting from his advisors to make some sort of preliminary announcement that we had this new weapon, which the military didn't want to do, understandably. So what resulted was a kind of much more general statement that if the Japanese choose not to surrender, we will unleash enormous forces against you. that was kind of a vague version of an attempt to alert the Japanese that we had such a new weapon. It didn't have any effect. They simply said, we're going to ignore that.
Right. The test took place while Truman was in Potsdam meeting with the big three. But he did tell Churchill about it. He told Churchill all about it. But he was very vague when he talked to Stalin. He just said, we have a new weapon. And Stalin just responded, well, I hope you use it on the Japanese. Now, we find out much later that Stalin actually had spies in Los Alamos, and they knew all about it anyway.
You know,
Stalin actually had the plans by then, yes.
Right.
I want to turn to our moral philosopher again, because there's a piece of the moral question that they might not have been thinking about at the time. I just don't know. But, like, there was also a legacy of nuclear warfare. And how do you factor in the whole future that brings to the world when you think about the morality of this moment?
Right. Yeah, I think the way to frame this conversation as the legacy of the atomic bomb does raise it kind of changes the moral landscape, because there was heavy bombing going on the continent already, that in some sense the nuclear bomb was of a piece with the kind of destruction of continental European cities and Germany that was already going on. But something about that event does, I tried to allude to it in this generational sense, that I grew up in the wake of that legacy of that bomb, and it had kind of profound a profound effect on maybe how we think about war and our place in international politics and our role on the global stage. Not to speak for like entire generation in saying that, but I do think that.
The generational thing is super interesting. I was raised by a hippie, you know,
and as was I, right?
That also colors how you think about something like nuclear war.
Yeah. I mean, on the question of like how far into the future do we need to anticipate the moral implications of our acts, I'll just defer to a far better philosopher than myself, Aristotle. At one point in the Nicomachean Ethics, he says, or he writes, well, his son takes notes on what he's saying, to get it to be very precise there. He says, well, perhaps I've lived a very good life and I've raised my children well and they are leading good lives and they have children and I see them and they've raised good lives or they're leading good lives. But I'll die at some point and my generational line, I just won't be here. At what if it turns out that like my great, great, great grandchildren just turn out terribly and are morally despicable people, does that redound to my character? And Aristotle just throws his hands up at that point in the text and just says, this is impossible to calculate. You know, this is too high of a standard to hold one person, or, and we can generalize here, one act to calculate out generation upon generation upon generation of the moral implications of an event in real time. So, and I think, you know, he's a far better philosopher than I am. And I think he's probably right to hold that to a very high standard.
Yeah. Let's talk.
Let me just interject. When you talk about the aftermath, we're no longer talking about one country having a monopoly and having a couple of bombs in its bomb bay. We're talking about tens and literally hundreds of thousands of these weapons. At one point, at the height of the Cold War, between the Soviet Union and the United States, there were enough nuclear weapons around so that every human being on Earth could be blasted with 3,000 pounds of TNT equivalent. So that's a totally different, I'm sure, moral universe as well as every other kind of universe. And the calculations are perhaps much more profound than simply one bomb, which looked very much to the military like just another firebomb. I think one of the tragedies of the use of these weapons in the war was that they were not so much more powerful than 1,000 B-29s dropping firebombs. And they left our government in the post-war years somehow thinking and writing that that they could be used in war, when in fact, as soon as another country acquired a few, we were immediately at a position of stalemate. It's very significant that there have been no world wars since 1945, and that these weapons have never again been used in anger.
Well, let's talk to Russell in Mountain City, Kansas. Hi, Russell. Russell, are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go on ahead.
Okay. My 3 or 4 years ago, my wife and I visited Los Alamos and went to the museum there. And one of the fascinating parts of the whole story for me was the story about the development of the camp. It was, they took over a church camp way out in the country outside of Los Alamos and kind of turned it into, the facility where the research and the work on the bomb would be done. You know, they had P.O. boxes in Los Alamos and everything. But, and Mr. Rhodes can be more accurate on the timeline of all this than I can, but it struck me that it was well in advance of the actual date of dropping the bomb that all this work on the infrastructure and setting up this town and populating it with scientists was going on. That, you know, my reflection after looking at that was, you know, this was a solution that was being developed to a problem that was, you know, maybe theoretically somewhere out in the future was there any sense of pressure on Truman to say, well, you know, we have this solution, now let's go find a situation that justifies the use of this solution.
Yeah, let's get some answers. Richard Rhodes, you can start us out.
Okay. This is a variation of a question that's often asked, which is, would Truman or Roosevelt have used this bomb on Berlin had it been available before Germany surrendered? And, there's no way to answer a question like that. But really, that question speaks to the question of whether this was a racist weapon, whether we used it on Asian peoples and would not have used it on European peoples. I find it hard to believe that it would not have been used anywhere that was a target once it was available. But understand the core for the parts, sorry, the uranium pieces of that first bomb, Little Boy, that was dropped on Hiroshima, were delivered by air to an island 1,000 miles away, Tinian, just a couple of days before that bomb was used. And the core for the Nagasaki bomb was actually flown out from Los Alamos in between the days, August 6th, the Hiroshima bomb, August 9th, the Nagasaki bomb. They were just putting these things together at the very last minute from materials that were just then being produced.
I've got to jump in because I'm really curious whether Mark Adams can tell us, what can you tell us about how visitors wrestle with all this stuff at the Truman Library? People have made some kind of pilgrimage.
Yeah, well, you certainly get a lot of veterans that come in from World War II and their descendants to come in and pay homage to Truman. They come to his gravesite and they thank him for saving their lives. Because they were in the Pacific Theater or they were children of soldiers in the Pacific Theater. The other point there, too, about the from your caller about, you know, the solution that was, you know, kind of we went an end around there a little bit, that was never a consideration. As I said at the beginning, Truman's main aim was to end the war as quickly as possible.
Mark Adams, Director of Education at the Truman Library, Adrian Switzer, Philosophy Professor at UMKC, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Richard Rhodes, author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb, thank you.
Thank you.
That wraps up our discussion of the atomic bomb, but you can keep talking on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. We're off to a break, but Central Standard will return. Stay with us. If you're on Facebook and you live in Kansas City, there's a good chance you've seen house listings from a group called Urban Cool Realty, mid-century modern abodes and fixer-uppers' dreams tucked away in Kansas City neighborhoods for what some might call a steal. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and that project has been really popular, but it's also stirred up its fair share of debate about real estate and gentrification. The couple who started it is here in the studio with me now to share that story. Franny Knight, Hubert Beattie, good morning.
Good morning.
So Franny, start me off by explaining what Urban Cool Realty is. I see the listings passed around, but I'm not sure I totally get it.
Yeah, so we're actually Urban Cool KC team of Chartwell Realty. We started a team and a Facebook page about 6 years ago to basically be the Kansas City cheerleaders of houses, cool houses and neighborhoods for Kansas Cityans who maybe don't know about some of the really great older neighborhoods, some of the great houses that are just amazing.
Hubert, talk to me about where the idea for all of this came from.
Well, it originated with Franny. She wanted to start a Facebook page. Naturally, I'm old school real estate, so I said it would probably, it just probably wouldn't work. And as it started to grow, put some of the houses on there that I had listed, and they and the response was incredible. So
yeah, I mean, I would say it's gone semi-viral in a contained local way.
Yes.
What are some of your favorite houses that you've listed this way, or the ones that have gotten a huge amount of response?
Probably the older ones built around the 1900s that have been renovated. Personally, those are probably my favorite. And they do get a large response because you don't see those today.
So, Franny, lately there have been some accusations that you guys are part of a problem with gentrification. Can you talk to me about that criticism?
Well, we're just really first and foremost real estate agents. And we kind of want to leave that whole topic to the experts, our urban planners and community developers are really much better at handling that than us. We do see signs of it, and we have to kind of work around it. But it's such a complicated issue, really. I mean, there's so many layers to it, and I wouldn't even know where to begin in such a short segment.
Yeah, take me on your personal journey. I mean, when did you first become aware that gentrification was a thing and that would play into what you were doing in different Kansas City neighborhoods?
Oh, sure. Well, the West Side is probably the best example of what I saw originally a few years ago and how that all came to be. There was a lot of pushback on the West Side when they started building the modern homes that are now anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million in a neighborhood where you can also still buy a $60,000 home and with a mix of races and levels of income. And I feel like they really have done a very good job of keeping that mix in place. And I think Kansas City is kind of unique in that way, that we can do that. Like Columbus Park is our latest one that we've had some discussion on. We listed a property that was over $1 million. It was a big project. It had five different units and beautiful historic building. And it's in the middle of, just like the West Side, a bunch of other homes that are within $50,000 to $100,000.
Did you go into all of this understanding that there would be debate around gentrification?
No, we're real estate agents first, again, so we're not really thinking about that all the time.
How did you, Hubert, initially hear some of those questions and concerns?
Well, certainly through Facebook, you get more of a feedback from people as to their fears and concerns. And also, Franny and I travel whenever we get a chance. So we've been to the West Coast, San Francisco, Oakland area, and some of the other major cities in the country.
All dealing with this.
All dealing with it, yes.
What were some of the specific concerns or criticisms people articulated that really made you aware that you were stepping into controversial territory?
Well, it's just fears that we sometimes hear, and I really don't want to go into the details of the personal fears, and if most people have them. It's just that really concerns of the future.
Their ability to live in the neighborhoods they've lived in the way they are used to, for
example? At times, yes. Something along that line.
I mean, has the realization that this was a concern and a question that was out there, that gentrification is just on people's minds, has that caused you to adapt your approach at all?
Well, it certainly, again, like Franny has said, we're real estate agents. So when a client wants a particular house in a particular area and they're comfortable with the price, all parties, we'll go ahead and sell it to them simply because that's our jobs. The social aspect of it is probably plays in our mind, but that's just not something that we're focused on.
Franny, what does the phrase urban cool mean to you? That's a phrase you use, and it seems like people understand it. You know, they when these listings get passed around, there is a lot of enthusiasm. What does it mean, urban cool?
Well, that's it's kind of a dividing line, sort of like we have in Kansas City, because in other cities, urban means, I think, something different than in Kansas City. Urban to me is both the midtown area, the older neighborhoods that where you can walk to all the amenities. That's to me urban. Like New York City, urban is all of New York City, really. And so Kansas City has some of that flair, mostly, I think, in like Brookside and the Plaza, Northeast.
Which, like Brookside, if you were visiting from New York, you might not call that urban at all.
True, right. That's a good point. Yeah, so in the Midwest, we have different definitions of urban, I believe. I think a lot of people buying real estate in Kansas City would probably consider Brookside as an urban neighborhood.
Hubert, what about you? How would you define urban and urban cool especially?
Well, Franny brought the name up. And again, I had my reservations.
Like what? What were your reservations?
Well, how that was going to be received by the general public, urban cool. How would they, you know, sort of respond to that? So we talked about it. And again, it's another one of those situations that I was wrong on. And it just kind of took off.
I'm curious about your mission. I mean, obviously you want to sell houses. You've made it clear that that is your primary goal. But the life of these listings goes beyond people who are interested in buying houses. It's, as we've said, like kind of a social media phenomenon to check out these quote unquote urban cool homes. What do you think that's about? Is that part of your mission?
I just think, like, I'm from Wichita originally. And when I moved to Kansas City, I was blown away with the beautiful houses of Kansas City. And I just wanted people to be just see them. So, like, the Northeast was the first neighborhood that I was like, holy cow, what the heck is going on in this neighborhood with the Queen Anne's? And, oh, my gosh, it's just beautiful. And to me, that's my mission, is unique, historic, beautiful homes that people may not see in their own neighborhoods.
Let people see
them. That expands their horizons to see what Kansas City's really made up. Oh my gosh, it's amazing to me.
And there's not much I can add to that. It just, in a sense that you're living in a certain area, you shop in a certain area, and you don't necessarily see the what Kansas City has to offer in all areas of town. And so I think really what we've been able to do is allow people to see those, that because we do hear it from time to time. Gosh, I didn't know this house existed. I didn't know this area existed. I'm really surprised that Kansas City has something like this. So it's basically we try to showcase the areas of the city that a lot of people don't know exist.
Franny has said that she was surprised when she first started seeing some of these featured homes and that just the kind of housing stock that exists in Kansas City. Was there a home that you saw that surprised you?
In what way?
Just a home that you guys have listed, or a neighborhood where you've listed a home, where your first visit you looked around and thought, whoa.
Probably not really surprising me. I can see where certain characteristics of homes are popular, but I've yet to see a house that just kind of wow.
Totally shocked you.
You're right.
Well, so you're going to be the tough audience for Franny, I guess. Hubert, do you have any last words on this question about gentrification? I mean, it is a complicated issue, and how do you think about it?
Well, you know, it's, again, we're not the experts. You know, it is happening. You know, my own personal feelings really don't enter into our business side of it.
So I guess that leaves the personal feelings up to our listeners out there, and you can talk to us about them on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Our time is up. We just spoke with the couple behind Urban Cool Realty. Franny, Hubert, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation and our longer discussion about the atomic bomb featuring celebrated author Richard Rhodes from Kansas City later today. We'll have it all ready for you at kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next with Steve Kraske.